Hello, I'm Mia Valdez. It is September 22nd, 2020. I am in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I'm calling my grandfather, Carlos Homero Valdez, over the phone, and he is in Colorado Springs, Colorado, visiting family. We're going to be talking about labor unions and South Texas steelworkers. Hello, Grandpa.
Hello there, Mia. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Is it okay if I record you?
Of course it's okay.
Okay, good. So to get started, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, about your life, and who you are?
Okay. I am Carlos H. Valdez. I'm a senior. I am the grandfather of Mia Gabriela Valdez. I have lived in Corpus Christi, Texas all my life and worked at ASARCO for 20 years, from 1967 to 1985. That is 18 years, but whenever the plant closed, they moved us all up to 20 years, gave us the rounded off. And it was very interesting there. For 20 years there, got involved with the union, and learned a lot of things. A lot of the beliefs that I have today were founded, you know, in those years, in the late 60s and early 70s. So that's about the start of it.
Okay. Can you tell me about your childhood and where your father and mother worked, and a little bit about your teenage, early years?
Okay. My mother was Carolina Villarreal Valdez. My father was Jose G. Valdez Jr. And we lived at 1925 Horn Road since about 1954, 1953. We moved from 434 Hiawatha, where we were renting a house. No, actually, we were buying the house. And a gentleman by the name of Mr. Woodruff would come and collect a mortgage payment every month. So then in 1953, we bought a brand new house in the John Jones subdivision on 1925 Home Road. And I lived there until I got married and then moved in with my wife and started a family. And the rest goes from there.
Okay.
My teenage years were interesting. I went to Catholic school for 10 years of my life. From kindergarten, I went to Cathedral High School, and I went to Cathedral all the way up to the sixth grade. And then we moved, and when we moved, I started going to Christ the King Catholic school from the seventh to the eighth grade. I went to College Academy, Catholic High School, the ninth grade. And then I moved to Carroll High School in the 10th grade, and I graduated from Carroll High School in 1963. I went to Del Mar College and studied mechanics, and I got a mechanics certificate degree, and did mechanic work for a little bit, and then my dad told me that they were hiring at ASARCO, and I took the offer because it was going to more than double my pay, so my mechanic work was history.
Oh, okay. I know that you were in the National Guard, so can you tell me a little bit about that as well?
Yes, I joined the National Guard in 1967, I think. Yes, and I was in the National Guard for 6 years, and I think I came out like in 72. Went to weekly meetings, not weekly meetings, but supposedly monthly meetings. And how I joined the National Guard because was that when I was at Del Mar, I had about 4 or 5 months left before I finished my mechanic certificate, and I got drafted. So there was no way out of the draft, so I went to the office there at Del Mar, and one of the persons that worked there, his name was Mr. Ditto, and Mr. Ditto was a captain in the National Guard. And he said, Carlos, he said, you don't have to worry about not finishing your mechanic school. He said, you can go ahead and finish it, and you can join the National Guard, and it'll be something that you'll enjoy. You go to meetings once a month, you go to summer camp once a year, and you'll meet your obligation to for military service that way. So I was going to do anything that I could to finish my mechanic certificate education. So I went, I did that, I joined the National Guard and finished my certificate program at Del Mar for auto mechanic studies. And so then I went in, I joined the National Guard, started going to weekly meetings. But of course, if you know, at that time, shortly thereafter, the Vietnam War really took off. And instead of weekly meetings, we were doing meetings every other week. And of course, that created a little bit of a hardship on me because when I went to the meeting, you know, my job would let me go, but I didn't get paid. You know, that would so if I wasn't off on the weekends, which I worked rotated shifts, if I wasn't off on the weekends, well, I just missed 2 days on that paycheck. Well, when I started going to meetings twice a month, well, that really put strain on the paycheck. Mm. But in any event, I got through it and finished my obligation to the military. I think you know what? I joined the National Guard in 1965. I'm sorry. I joined the National Guard in 1965, and I completed my obligation in 1971. So yeah, those were 6 years, and it was fun. I liked the outdoors, so. To summer camp, we went to Fort Hood, Texas, which is extremely hot. So we went in the summer, so it was not unusual for the temperature to reach over 100 degrees, and training had to be stopped, you know, several times because it was just dangerous to be out there moving around in the heat. But in spite of all that, I enjoyed it.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Let's see. How about, could you tell me about your hobbies now and what you like to do now and what you're involved with?
Okay. One of my hobbies was hunting, and I hunted for probably about 45 years. And the last place I hunted was a piece of property that my son owned in Goliad, Texas. And whenever he sold the place, because he was going to start a business, well, that was when I stopped hunting because if you wanted to get a good lease, you have to pay about $5,000 a year. And I was not willing to put that out there or hunting. I had hunted all my life and was able to afford the lease, and we always had year-round leases, and we could go out to the place throughout the year and fix our blinds and, just keep things, nice and tidy. But at that point, it was just impossible, So I sold my blind and my theater and everything. And so that was a very enjoyable period of my life because I enjoyed the outdoors. We always visited the parks, so outdoors was something that I really liked. But during that time, I also took up the hobby of photography, and I've been taking pictures for many, many years. And being that I liked the outdoors, when I retired 10 years ago, in 2009, I became a master gardener because I was always interested in having my yard nice, and I was interested in plants and stuff like that. And so by becoming a master gardener, I learned how to maximize my time and keep up with all the latest trends in gardening and turf management and things like that. So that was, and I am a master gardener to this day. And then right after that, being that I like the outdoors, I saw an ad in the paper that if you wanted to become a master naturalist, well, then, go to this meeting on such and such a day. So I did go to that meeting, and I've been a master naturalist now for about 10 years. And I was elected president twice, and vice president one time. And the last office that I held was I was a intern training coordinator, which I did training for all the interns that were coming into the master naturalist. I did that up until last year. So those the outdoors and gardening, are very much a very big part of my life. Back in 1981, we went to Rocky Mountain National Park. The whole family went in my green 1976 pickup, and everybody fit in the front seat. There was no extended cab at the time. So we went and spent an enjoyable time up in Rocky Mountain National Park. I went back to the 100th anniversary of Rocky Mountain National Park. That has always been one of my favorite parks to go to, even though that we have been to several other national parks, Yosemite included, and Yellowstone, and Bryce Canyon, and Zion National Park. We've been to a bunch of parks. But Rocky Mountain National Park has remained one of my favorites. Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you. And he does have a very nice garden, and I can vouch for that, and very nice pictures as well. So now if we're going to get into the subject. If you want to tell me how you got introduced to Asarco, how you got introduced to the plant.
Well, as I said, I was working as a mechanic assistant at Lou Williams Chevrolet at the time, and my dad told me that they were hiring at the plant, that I would be interested. And I said, well, I might be. What kind of work am I going to be doing? I said, well, you're probably going to be doing pick and shovel work. I said, oh, well, that doesn't sound too inviting, but anyway, tell me more. How much is it paid? And he said, well, they're going to start you off at $3.52 an hour. At that time, I was making $1.25 an hour. That was the minimum wage at the time. So, man, my eyes about just popped out of the socket. I I said, my God, I'm going to triple my salary. You know, yes, pick and shovel work, but it can't be that bad for them, for that money. So I told him yes. He took me to the personnel office. And in January the 27th, 1967, I started working at a Sarco. And I worked there till 1985. And in, at a Sarco, I became aware of several things. I became aware that, that there was racism in our society, even though that we had fought a civil war, and several, you know, pieces of legislation had been passed, you know, to not have that. It still got, people got around the law, and because there was no severe consequences for the action, it continued to perpetuate itself. So I became involved in the union because I felt that it was a good way for me to learn more about our country. And that's when I realized that we live in a political country, and he who has the political will make the rules and regulations for our country.
Mm-hmm.
So I had several jobs in the union. My first job was living welfare chairman, which I went out to the widows of the deceased members and presented them with a Bible and offered the union's help in anything that they needed.
Mm-hmm. Could you repeat that part? What was the name of the job?
Good and Welfare Chairman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I went and visited the widows of our members that had passed and presented them with a Bible from the Steelworker Union, Local 5022, mm-hmm. and offered the union's help in anything that they needed. So I did that for a while, and then my interest, you know, continued to increase in politics, and I became the political action chairman for the rest of the time that I worked at the plant. Political action chairman was the person that introduced people that were running for office, whom we supported and why we supported them, mm-hmm. and encouraged the members to register to vote, to mm-hmm. go out and vote, and to get involved in the candidate's campaign by passing out literature, bumper stickers, putting up signs and things like that, meeting the candidates and all that stuff. Really enjoyed it. During that time, I became the election judge in my precinct and the precinct chairman. I did that for 42 years, quite an enjoyable time of my life. Getting to meet our neighbors, friends and neighbors that lived in the neighborhood, and help them with election duties that I had.
Hmm.
It was very nice, and I enjoyed helping the people answering their questions, you know. And we had my wife help me run the elections, and two dear friends, one of them that since passed away, and this old lady now lives in Houston with her daughter. But those times at the elections, it was very enjoyable for me. We had very many good times there that I remember, and I said I did that for 42 years.
Wow.
Attended every state convention since George McGovern was the candidate for president. I attended every state convention. This last one, of course, it was virtual,
mm-hmm.
but other than that, we attended the state Democratic convention every 2 years. Those were held all around the state, even here in Corpus Christi, but mainly they were held in San Antonio, El Paso, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, and places like that. Another thing that I really enjoyed, going and hearing the candidates, meeting them, and see the positions that they were taking on issues that were important to us as a union and as members of the middle class of our society.
Mm-hmm. So kind of backtracking back to your entrance to the union, or to ASARCO, so I was going to ask, what type of training did you need, but did your, since we already know that you have your mechanic certificate, was that a good, did that help you?
Well, actually, no, that didn't come into play. When you work, you want to work at a circle, and as my father told me, you're going to work, pick your shovel work, you went in as a laborer. You were a laborer, and you belong to the labor pool. And the labor pool had certain duties that they had to perform during the day. Now, that same labor pool was also a pool that was used to the labor pool was used to supplement people that were going out on vacation, people that were out sick and stuff like that. So as those openings occurred, then people from the labor pool were pulled by seniority, the least seniority that you had, and you were the first one to be called for those openings. And the reason I say it was by seniority, because if you went to work let's say in a department called leech, well, that was shift work. And shift work was 7 to 3, 3 to 11, and 11 to 7. So very few people wanted to work shift work. So the more seniority you had, the longer you stayed in the labor pool. But eventually, my goal was to become a leadman. And when I reached about 9 years in the plant, I was always taking the test, and I knew when my time would come because of my seniority to where I was going to get a leadman job. And for the last 10 years, my employment with ASARCO, I was a relief leadman. And I enjoyed being a relief leadman because I had to learn 10 different jobs because I had to relieve the leadman for those shifts. So there was four shifts in every department. There was four departments there. And then all those departments all had different duties. And I was always very interested in the production of zinc. ASARCO was a zinc refinery. We took zinc ore that came in railroad gondolas, and it was put into the ASARCO refining process through a belt, and by the time all that process was done, then there was two products that came out of that. One was zinc that came out in ingots of 2,200 pounds, and there was cadmium, which was a byproduct of the zinc, and cadmium is used to make chrome and other products. So that was the process, and I was very interested in the process. I've always been interested in machinery and in processes, you know, that go from one stage to the next, to the next, to the next. And that was where I worked. I worked in the first stage of the zinc process, which was the leach. And this is where the ore was separated from the tiny particles of zinc that were in the ore, and the what we call the residue, which was like red mud, separated. And then that solution that was made, that was purified, was sent to a department called the cell house. And at that point, that solution was ran through a series of what they call cells that had aluminum sheets that were in those cells that hung in those cells. And as that solution went through, it was electrolytes. So as that solution went through, electricity went to the cells and it attracted the tiny particles that were in that solution to the cell. Okay, and every 24 hours, those sheets were pulled up and the zinc was stripped off those cells, those cell sheets, and then that zinc, which was highly impure, was then taken to a place where it was melted, and then it was purified at that point. And then it was cast into 2,200 pound ingots that flipped the refinery.
Wow, that's really neat. I never knew any of that. So let's see. How would you say that the environment of ASARCO changed over time?
Well, ASARCO was not a very good corporate neighbor. ASARCO got cited many, many times for pollution violations, for dumping cadmium into the chip channel. You couldn't fish right there in the chip channel because all the water was polluted. And ASARCO was not a good environmental partner. They skirted the laws and the rules, you know, forever. And they never updated their equipment. There was equipment that could be used to, you know, minimize the pollution that they were putting out into the air and harming the neighborhood around there, which the neighborhood is called Donna Park. And those people there all had, not all, but most of them had cadmium or zinc in their blood, which was detrimental to their health. But ASARCO got cited many, many times. And eventually, they had to close down because the plant just could not operate anymore. They were really on them because they never modernized anything, or they just keep operating. They kept operating like they did when they started operating the plant back in the early 40s. And finally, they just, you know, in 1985, that was the end of the dance because they just, the EPA would not let them, you know, spew out all that pollution into the air and dirty the air and of course, make life miserable for the residents of Donna Park and elsewhere in the community.
Mm-hmm. So, more about that. What were the working conditions like for you?
Well, the working conditions, being a member of the union, we negotiated for working conditions, pay, and things like that. So the working conditions were tough. It was hard work. It was hot, and it was dusty and dirty, and you know, you had to wear a mask in certain parts of the process, and. One of the things that we worked with was asbestos. As the ore was running through the process in different pipes, of course, there's those tiny bits of zinc in the ore. And as the ore ran through all these pipes and everything, well, in the turns, you know, holes started to be made in the pipe. And how did we patch those holes? We had a bucket with asbestos, and we put water in it and made a kind of like a dough and go and patch those holes with asbestos. So a lot of the guys that worked there, you know, were tested first, Mestis, and they tested positive. I was always very, very firm about wearing my mask, you know, when I was going to do jobs that, you know, put me in more danger than just the mere fact of working there. So I got tested, and I tested negative. So, but those that tested positive, they received a monetary settlement, which I was not interested in. I wanted my health more than any money that I could get. So,
mm-hmm.
That was.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. So, for people, once you were in the union, what did it look like for people trying to join the union?
What?
Whenever, so you were in the union, right? And then,
mm-hmm.
So what was it like for people trying to join the union?
Oh, it was easy. We encourage all new employees to join the union,
mm-hmm.
because every benefit that we had out there had been negotiated by the union, and those of us that came in, like me, in 1967, well, you know, somebody had negotiated those benefits for us before us. So, and nothing is free, you know. We negotiated with a SARCO for the benefits that we had, and we had very, very good benefits.
Yeah. So, as a union, what did you guys accomplish inside the workplace and outside the workplace?
Well, inside the workplace, we accomplished very good working conditions for our members, mm-hmm. good pay, good health benefits. We had two in the family, your father and your aunt, Diana. And those two kids that my wife and I had, we didn't pay 1 cent for their hospital stay, their maternity visits for my wife, your grandmother, and all of that. So that was a benefit that we, among other benefits, healthcare benefits that we negotiated for. So. Healthcare was good. The pay was good. As I said, you know, we were making three times the minimum wage. And one of the things that we found out, I forget what year that was, but the Steelworker Union filed a suit against the school district because of de facto and de jure segregation. That suit went to the Supreme Court twice, and twice we won the suit. And it was concerning, you know, that the schools on the west side were in very poor condition in relationship to those in the south side. So one of the examples was when Edward Moody was built. Well, it was built at the same time that King was built. Well, King had a planetarium, and Moody did not have anything, not even close to that. But that was the way the discrimination was going on in our community, and those in the school board and were of course, they were a party to that. So we sued the school district, and we won. After we won, there was school busing, you know, because they were putting, you know, too many people in the same race into one school. You know, they would make schools on the west side so everybody in the west side could go there. Well, there was no integration, you know. So the students that were in the schools on the west side never knew how the students in the south side were living. So consequently, it was a surprise, you know, whenever they finished school, that all the things that the kids on the south side did. Well, busing opened up the eyes of the students in the west side to find out that, you know, they actually were being brought to school by their parents in a car instead of going on the bus or walking. So this opened up the eyes of students to find out, you know, well, how did that come about? And it came about by them having a better interest in education and in improving themselves and their livelihood, you know, as they became members of the workforce. I always believe, and it's a fact, that the unions in this country created the middle class. The unions and the GI Bill created the middle class because it gave us, it gave the people a good salary, gave them good benefits, which they can aspire for better things, and educate their children. They could put money away for college. They could go on vacations, eat out every once in a while, and things like that. So it was a great boost to quality of life. Every benefit that any worker has today was at some point or another negotiated in a union contract by a union. And I'm talking about the 40-hour week, the 8-hour day, time and a half after 40 hours, and all those things. Reynolds Metals they negotiated a plan that every 5 years, their employees got 13 weeks paid vacation. You wouldn't get docked for jury duty. And a bunch of benefits that we got, the membership, which helped us live a better life and become more aware of all those benefits got acquired through the union and through us electing candidates for office that promoted our union through the legislature and things like that, and help pass laws that now, you know, everybody works 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week and time and a half after 40 hours. We got paid double time and a half if you worked on a holiday, and a series of benefits that was a good thing for the members. The quality of life was improved. So consequently, our members lived a good life and made them aspire and dream for better things.
Okay. Wow, that's so cool that you had all those benefits and you got to be there and experience everything. So did you ever experience or see discrimination or racism at the plant, and what happened?
No, at the plant, there was no discrimination because we had a union contract, and everything was done, you know, within the contract. Now, if the company violated the contract in any way, the member would file agreements, and we would go through the grievance process, you know, to make the member whole. So there was never any overt discrimination because we had a system of seniority. So if you didn't have the seniority and you applied for a job and somebody else with more seniority than you applied, well, the seniority would rule. So there was really no way to discriminate somebody other than just treating them bad and things like that, and those things were taken up in the grievance process.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense then. Mm-hmm. So I guess let me see. I know that Dad told me that I was talking to him about this, about how we were going to do the interview, and he mentioned that there were pranks that people would play at the plant, and sometimes they were mean. And he was saying that something about the zinc and that they would make the bar real hot for the next person to touch it. Is
Oh,
that...
that was
So can you tell me about that?
that was a prank that people, you know, people do that all over the place, and you see it in school, and you see it all over the place. But what he's talking about is that there was a we had to do certain jobs that required using tools, electrical tools, you know, tools, power tools, and one of the power tools for was in the process of zinc making, how we separated the residue, what we call that red mud, from the to make a clear solution to where you could extract the zinc from it. They went, the solution went into this huge round cylinders that sat, and they held 5,000 gallons.
Oh, can you repeat that? It cut out. Sorry.
Okay. The solution went into this long cylinders that held about 5,000 gallons. Okay. Once the 5,000 gallons were in those cylinders, that air pressure was put in there to push the solution through a series of pyramid structures that were made out of wood and covered with canvas. And the air pressure would push the solution through that canvas and into that wooden structure that was there that had a bunch of little channels, and it would channel the solution, and it would come out through the middle. Well, eventually those triangles had to be pulled out, and the cloth had to be changed on those elements. Well, when you took there was a big old nut that held there was two nuts that held those elements in place. And so we would, you know, take the nuts off and the elements would fall out. Well, in putting those nuts back on, you know, sometimes you would get a nut and it was and the guy sometimes it would strip that nut on purpose, you know, just to get it extremely hot. So one of the
Oh wait, can sorry, can you repeat that? It cut out for a second.
Okay, one of the times that we were changing out the elements, they stripped the nut, and the nut of course got real hot. The nut got hot. We were wearing gloves, and they passed it off to this new guy that had just gotten hired, and told him, "Hey, can you take this to McGee?" So when the guy took the nut, it was flaming hot, and he didn't have any gloves on, so it burned his hand. You know, it was a prank, not a very nice thing to do, but that was what your dad is talking about.
Yeah, I wanted you to mention that because that's not something that's usually in any writings, or that's only something that you can know from personal experience. So I wanted to hear about that. Well, I've asked about all I wanted to know, so are there any things that you wish I would have asked or that you want to talk about?
No, I want to say that since unions became for necessity, without unions, there was child labor, there was, you know, people that were worked to death and things like that, so unions came about by necessity, and as soon as unions became, you know, legal and things like that, business and corporations have tried their best, you know, not all of them, but a majority of them have tried their best to make it hard for unions to organize, make it illegal for unions and things like that. So, now, you know, union membership has gone down because they've made it hard for people to join unions and things like that. But I sincerely believe that if we had a unionized society, we would have more people making a decent salary to where they can make a decent living, and their families and their children, but I'm talking about the family and the children, that's the same thing. But the family could enjoy, you know, more things like vacations, going to the movies, eating out, and things like that. You could save money for your kids to go to college and those kind of things. So it would benefit society as a whole. But of course, you know, fairness is not something that our society is really famous for. You know, our country is checkered with incidents over history where, you know, things like slavery and other things, you know, have happened in our country where, you know, human abuse, you know, has been very prevalent, and it is still today, you know. Mm-hmm. So unions played a big part in our society today, where people join the middle class, you know, make good money, and people always say, well, you're gonna ask for more money, and then the company's gonna go broke. I mean, how stupid can you be to try to negotiate something like that, and how stupid can the company be to give you something like that that's gonna make them go broke? We know how much we can ask for, and the company knows how much they can give, and that's what the negotiations is all about, to bring about a fair salary for a fair day's work, and the members can enjoy the fruits of their labor, and, you know, the family can enjoy, you know, many things, a good quality of life.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much, Grandpa, for helping me with this and answering everything so diligently. And I appreciate your time so much. And I love you.
Well, you know what? There's nothing I wouldn't do for my first grandchild. We love you dearly. There's nobody that loves you more except your parents. Your parents love you more than we love you.
Maybe.
We waited for you for so long, and we are so happy with you. And as I told you earlier, I am so proud of you. And I am sure that there is many, many grandparents out there that would just love to have a grandchild like you.
Thank yes. you.
And I mean that sincerely. And I always talk about you all. And one thing I don't do is I never lie, but I tell the truth, and the truth is, you know, just beautiful to hear other people, and they say, man, you're so lucky. Yes, we are. We are lucky. Lucky to have my two children, lucky to have my five grandchildren, all of them, you know, people that are, you know, doing good in society. Good people that learned, you know, the benefits of education. Of course, their parents, you know, had a lot to do with it along the way. But I wake up every day and I always say, thank you, God, for another day, and thank you for all your blessings. And the blessings include every single one of you all.
Oh, well, we learn from the best.
Well, thank you.
Oh, well, all right. Well.
Okay, Mia, anything else that I can do for you? You know that I am at your beck and call 24/7.
Of course. And if there's anything else, I will not hesitate to ask you.
Please don't.
So, okay, well, I'll talk to you later, and thank you again so much.
Okay. Good night, Mia. All right. We'll see. We leave Friday, so we'll see you over the weekend.
Okay.
And love you dearly.
Okay. Love you too. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
All right. Bye.